welcome our tonight speaker, who is Dennis S. from Barnegat, New Jersey.
Okay, awesome. Hey, I'm Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. And, man, thanks a lot for having me up here. I love AA. And I'm just like riding this high today. Like, I just feel good, you know. And I drove up here and, I talked to a couple people before the meeting, man, and I was like getting all excited about this. And I'll tell you, I don't want to tell you what it was like now, you know, but I'm going to do that because it's already like coming over me, you know. I'm a guy that I considered myself hopeless, and I kind of wrote off any sobriety, any freedom from alcohol, basically any happiness, anything. I wrote off all the good things that I had at one time in my life, or that I had scattered throughout my life, and I resigned myself to drinking. And when I got to AA, I was 42 years old. It was December 18th of 2008, and I was just totally broken. I had been drinking for 28 years, most of that time against my will. And I had tried many times, many ways to stop and stay stopped. And I was unable to do it, you know, on my power, on any power, I thought, you know. And, on my last night of drinking, I was in Manasquan, New Jersey, at the Manasquan Tavern. I was pounding down scotch and beers. And I went over to my brother's new house for a little celebration, and we were drinking a handle of Jack Daniels, and I decided to drive home. And I got arrested again. And the next morning, I found myself in my condo, just out of ideas. And I was in so much pain, and I was so afraid. I had ripped through my family. I had ripped relationships with the people that cared about me the most to pieces. I was facing jail time, third DUI in New Jersey, 10 years, loss of license. I was basically unemployable. My home was in foreclosure. And a list of other things were going on. And they were turning things off in my house. And, I was, like, living to drink and drinking to live. And that morning was a little different. You know, I had woken up in that kind of condition many, 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 many times. But, that morning I was seriously thinking about blowing my brains out because I just didn't know what in the world I was going to do. You know, my problems had really, really piled up on me. And I was so ashamed. And I was so embarrassed that me, this guy with all this intellectual pride who thought he was so superior to everyone, could be just alone in his house, like dying from alcoholism, you know. And I had been remanded by the courts to go and have like the thing signed that you go to the meetings, you know. And I would sign it myself. And that morning I had the meeting list because you need to know where the meetings are in order to fill the thing out, you know. And I had been exposed to AA in the past, and I knew that if I called the hotline, that you guys would send two men to my house, and they would get me, and maybe they could help me. And, I believe that day was my first experience, at least that I can recall, and that is apparent to me looking back with step two. You know, I was willing to believe that maybe you guys could help me. I had run out of options. I was ready to blow my brains out. And I made the call, and a guy called me back. And I'll never forget, I hope I don't, standing in my condo doorway, looking up the street where I live, Radio Road in Little Egg Harbor, still live there, and looking for the description, just for the SUV that they described. And I saw it in the distance, and then it put the left blinker on, and it came in, man, and you guys came and got me, and it's been amazing. It's been unbelievable. They took me, these guys were not like big book people in any sense of the word, you know. They had found God, and they were experts at 12-step calls. Like, these guys were, like, seasoned. The guy that sat me across the table in the local McDonald's and basically told me his story and told me that I didn't have to live that way anymore and that there was hope for a guy like me You know, he was sober maybe 20 years. I don't know how many 12-step calls he had been on. Hundreds, probably. I mean, hundreds. And I could see, I was telling Sarah earlier, like, across the table at the McDonald's on day one, I could see so much compassion and so much understanding in this guy's face. He really didn't have to say anything to me. And I remember I was shaking and sweating and trying not to cry. And I kept telling him, guys, I'm going to die. I'm going to die out there. And, you know, I can still picture his face. And unfortunately, he passed away sober from old age and complications like a month or two ago. And, like, I just, that day just resonates with me. I remember some of the things that he said. And one of the things was in his story, he told me about how he was an off-duty cop in Jersey City in 1970. And he went out to the bar just to have a couple of drinks one night after work. And he got into a fight and he shot a guy dead. And he got 30 years to life in the penitentiary in New Jersey. And, you know, I never even had a bar fight. I'm not a fighter and I never carried a gun. And, of course, I never killed anyone. But I understood how he went out for a drink that night, an innocent drink, and it had just changed his life forever. You know, I came to AA that night, and I raised my hand in what I'll call a good old open discussion meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they welcomed me. And they had coffee, and they had cookies, and they reached out to me, and they introduced me to all the guys, and... Man, I was with you guys. Like, I was here. And what had happened was, you know, when I was a kid, I was like a lot of us. Like, I was like a disconnected kid, you know. I like to think sometimes, like, I was a lonely kid, you know. Like, I played with army men way too long. Like, you know, the kids were, like, out, like, Dayton and whatnot, and I was still in the basement with my army men and by myself, you know, and like I hung out in like every crew, like, you know, the burnouts, the jocks, it was the punk rock days of the late 70s when the mid 70s when I was a kid, and like I hung out in every crew, but I wasn't tight like with any of them, you know, like I was like the mayor kind of guy, you know, but always on the outside. And I picked up a drink when I was 14 years old, and it just took me. It took me immediately. And I remember I was at a beach party. I was 14 years old, going into freshman year of high school. I was at a beach party down on LBI, and the first night I drank four Michelobes, got a buzz, and the second night I drank five, and I smoked weed for the first time. And the obsession to get loaded just took me. And I had been an athlete and a really good student. I was in all the advanced classes. I was really good at baseball. I played football, and I was good. You know, I went both ways, and I had some potential maybe in that direction to play high school ball. And by the time I got out of high school, all that stuff was gone. It was almost like the day I picked up booze, it's all I did. And even like as a freshman, sophomore in high school, I would just, on Monday morning, all I could think about all day was Friday night. Friday night was the night. You know, when you're a kid, it's kind of hard to get loaded every day. I wasn't working. It wasn't like we had any money. And, you know, that leads me to another story that I'll tell you in a minute. And, you know, it started out like a lot of us. Like on the weekends, we would drink and we would get loaded. But all I thought about was the weekend. And then as time went on, I started, of course, to steal from my parents. I mean, even though we were drinking like 96-cent pints of Night Train wine, you still needed a buck. You still needed $2. If you had no money, where were you going to get it? And I started very small. And by the time I got out of high school, my mom was sleeping with her pocketbook under her pillow. And if she had anyone by the house, any women, all the pocketbooks had to be locked up. You know, there was a monster in the house, and I was the monster. And I did anything to get a drink, and I was really young. You know, I was like 16, 17, and sometimes they would set me up because I would always deny it to the end, you know. And they would leave the pocketbook out on the counter so that when I walked in the front door, I would see it. And I would think, no, Dan, you're being set up here. Don't take the money. And I would go upstairs and I would lay in my bed, and maybe it would be a minute, maybe it would be an hour, maybe it was in the morning early. I would go down and I would take the money and I would go out. And, you know, I remember coming back and more than one time and walking through that front door to both of my parents standing in the doorway of the kitchen in tears. Like, Dennis, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to us? What's going on? You need help. And, you know, I was a crazy kid. You know, I would run around the house and punch holes in the walls and tell them, you guys are crazy. You have the problem. It's not me. You know, I'm not hurting anyone. You know, and that became like, I'm not hurting anyone but myself. You know, I was just like I was crazy. And for years and years, my life was just driven by this obsession. And the obsession said, drink, 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 drink. And then sometimes that wouldn't work. And it would say, like, you're a loser. You're not good enough. You know, you're not fast enough. You're not smart enough. You know, she doesn't like you. She doesn't even talk to you. Just go in your room. Just go get the money. Go drink. And it was bad, and I was young. And I had, like, Bill talks about it. Like, I had made so many promises, and I had so many cheerleaders. Like, my family would just, like, sit by me, and, you know, there were times when it almost looked like I was going to get my stuff together, and my folks would be like, all right, yes, he met a nice girl. All that stuff's going to be behind him. And, you know, it never was. And I would always be asked the question, Dennis, what is wrong? What is wrong with you? And my answer was always the same. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. And, man, I was so, I lived in guilt and in shame, you know. I have a little brother. He's 9 years younger than me. He's not so little anymore, you know. But, you know, I remember he would, like, poke around outside my bedroom door, like, trying to listen in to what was going on in there. And I remember my mom catching him and asking him, like, what are you doing, John? And he would say things like, is my brother going to die? And my mom would tell me that, and I would just feel so ashamed of myself because I knew what I was doing in there. And, you know, I was killing them. And I, in the late 80s, I met some people down at LBI, and I had always thought, well, maybe if I go to school, because I'm a pretty smart guy, you know. And I came home, like, on August 28th one day and said, Ma, I want to go to Kutztown, right up the road here. And they were so happy. You know, and I kind of was, too. Like, I needed a change of environment. There was a lot of stuff going on in my life that I needed to get away from. And I did. I went up to Kutztown, and I probably would have done well there. But I never went to class. I never studied. I would just show up for the test, and I would fail miserably. And, you know, I got thrown out of there. I actually got yanked out by my folks. I had a .98 average. I just couldn't make it up the hill. I just couldn't do it. We drank 24/7. I learned how to drink a case of beer a day and do whatever else I could find on $50 a week. And, you know, I remember being in that apartment up there in K-Town and the phone ringing and my roommate giving me the phone and saying, Dan, it's your mom. And I said, hey, Ma, you know, what's up? And she says, Dennis, pack your things. We got your midterm grades. Let me tell you, the remorse and the horror on both ends of the phone, it was just unbelievable. I had to turn around to my friends and say, party's over, everyone. Dan's going home, you know. And demoralized completely. You know, the guy that had thought so well of himself, you know, so smart, so much potential, they told me, all the tests I took, you know. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And, you know, I went home and I started to try to stop because I knew, like, I was dying. Maybe I was 21, 22, and I'm dying inside and I'm all alone. And, you know, I just have this crazy, uncontrolled emotion. And I had that for years and years and years. Like I'm not a pet guy, but I would cry at like the poor kitty commercial or something like that, like the ASPCA. Like I couldn't control my emotions like at all, and it was insane. And my mom would say, like, "What, Dennis? What? And I started to hit rehabs, and I think I went to 4 rehabs, 3 detoxes, a couple halfway houses, or whatever you call it, recovery house, sober house. And, you know, I would go in with a firm resolution, and in my heart I would believe it, that I wanted it, and I was going to get it. And I would get out, and I would come to the meetings, and I would stay stopped, mostly out of fear that I was going to go back out to that life. For periods of time, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. 1 year I actually stayed sober for 13 months, just sitting in meetings, sitting on my hands. And every meeting I would share, you know, I want to get loaded. This thing is on me. You know, and eventually it would take me, like my highest resolve. In my heart, I wanted to stay sober, but my mind, it would just attack me. It would just say, drink, drink, you're a piece of crap, just do it, just one more time. And it was insane. You know, when I first read and was told by you guys that the main problem centers in my mind, I knew it. Like, I knew it. I'm crazy. And there were just a lot of years of that. And there were periods of time where I was able to, you know, I drank for a long time, so I'm not going to tell you every year that went by, but, you know, there were periods of time when I was able to stop or moderate. And it looked like I was in control of this thing if you only looked at a short period of time. But over the long haul, I would always go back to the hard drinking, like the day in, the day out drinking, you know, drinking against my will, having everything to lose. You know, like I always say, like I would build this house of cards and then anything would just come along and then my whole life would just go away, like right in front of my eyes. And it was painful for me, and it was probably even more painful for my family. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I remember getting let out of the Bergen County Annex, the Bergen County Jail, and I had gotten arrested. And my mom, she's a tough lady, and she called all my friends and she said, "Do not bail my son out." And I stayed there. And when I finally convinced my dad to come and get me, I remember they threw open like this garage door, and the people getting out went out to meet their people, and there was my dad like crying. And I'm crying too, and I give him a big hug, and I say, "Dad, that's it. I'm done. I learned my lesson." And like, really in my heart, I didn't want to do it again. And in 2 weeks, I was gone. And I was running hard, harder than ever. You know, and my grandma, when nobody wanted me, they took me in. And, you know, I remember the obsession so strong and the physical craving so strong that, like, I wanted to stop for her. I did. I didn't want to do what I was doing, not in her house. Like, I was robbing her. I was just a wild person. And I remember trying to go out the door one day, and she's blocking the door with her body, and she's on her knees, and she's pulling at my pants legs. And she's saying, "Dennis, please, please don't go." And I just, "Grandma, I got to go." It was just beyond anything that I could control. I just couldn't control it. And the guilt and the shame, and I was like this cycle. I was like a rat on a wheel. I would just drink more and more and more. And, you know, of course, in the end, the alcohol didn't work anymore, and I could drink, you know, I could drink so much that I would still feel like I was going to explode. You know, one time, years later, I remember I was watching this relationship with this girl that I was engaged to, and we owned a home, and, things were looking good, you know, for a time, and, I remember when that relationship fell apart and fighting one night and in so much pain and just dumping liquor down my throat, trying to kill the pain and just feeling like my head was just going to come off my shoulders and the booze wasn't working anymore. And, you know, she ran and got my family and they came bursting in the door. And they said, "Crystal said you're trying to kill yourself with booze." And, you know, really, I was just looking for, like, some relief, you know. And, you know, sometimes I would trade everything that was worth anything in my life for 5 minutes of relief because I hated sobriety. Like, I just couldn't be sober. I would wake up in the morning and the only thing I thought about was get loaded. And I did. And I can remember laying in bed, still dark out, and thinking, "I hope the sun cracks, there's a crack of light so I can get up and start hitting that thing, you know?" And that's how I lived my life. And I was a loser, and I was alone, and I was at my house, you know. And I had some periods of what society might call successes. like where I went to work, dressed kind of like this, and money came in from that job, and I bought a couple of homes and new cars, and for an uneducated guy, it looked good, but I threw it all away behind a drink. And in the end, you know, I was alone, and I was at my house, and I wanted to kill myself. And, you know, thank God that you guys were there and stopped what you were doing and came and got me that day. Because I don't know what would have happened. I don't know, you know. I came here with so many old ideas. You know, I would be bouncing along on a bottom in those last years. And I would call my friend who I had known for 20 years, and she's sober in AA, and she's just an awesome person. Like, she's one of those friends that, like, she's a lifelong friend, and it's somebody that, like, even if we haven't talked in 5 years, when we see each other, it's like we never skipped a beat. And, you know, I used to call her and say, hey, do you guys have a seat for me? I'm really, like, I'm hurting here. And as soon as she would say yes, I would immediately, like, turn it around and, like, attack her and say, like, you guys are a cult. I don't believe in God. There's no God. You're crazy. And those people, they're crazy. You know, my sponsor fired me back in 1987. Well, you know, she never pushed it on me. And when alcohol had beaten me to a place where I was out of all those ideas, and I was willing, I came. And I didn't want the answer to be God, but, like, I was out of options. And I knew you guys were about God. I knew it. And, you know, I went to my first meeting, and the people there were really, really supportive of me. And I met some awesome people. And, like, I remember this one dude who's still my friend. He, in those first days of my sobriety, he would make, like, a fuss over me when I got to the meeting. Like, as he saw me walking through the parking lot, he would, like, yell out my name and really, like, pay attention to me. And, man, I needed that. Like, I needed somebody who, like, cared about me enough, you know, like, that could help me. And a year later, after going through the steps, I would go back and judge those people because they weren't doing it the right way, in my mind. But I'm not going to tell you that story tonight because I don't have enough time. But what happened to me was I show up in AA, and I'm really willing, and I'm really desperate. But I'm running around with this obsession to drink, and it's on me. And I don't know what to do, and all I'm doing is running from meeting to meeting to meeting. I had this gift when I got sober. It was called the gift of unemployment. I was unemployable. All I did was just go to AA. I just went, because this thing was chasing me. You know, I would go to bed and say, after the 7 a.m. meeting, I'm gone. And I'd go to the 7 a.m. meeting. I would get that little bit of relief that we get from going to a meeting. And then that would kind of, like, take me into the 10 a.m. and the 12:30. And then I would go home, and maybe I would kind of lay down a little bit because I wasn't sleeping much. Or I'd go have a little lunch, and then I'd go to the nighttime meeting. You know, and I was surviving barely in the meetings. And it was getting really bad. And about 3 weeks, maybe almost 4 weeks of doing that, maybe I had gone to like 60 or 70 of our meetings. I was just a crazy person. In that time, I met a lot of people, and it was awesome. I was having a great time, but I was so afraid, you know, that I was going to drink. And on a Tuesday night in January of 2009, I had about maybe 3 or 4 weeks dry. I called my friend Sheila, and I said, Sheila, I'm in AA, and I'm going to a million meetings. I'm dying here. I'm going to drink. And she said, Dennis, do you have a sponsor? I said, not really. And she said, you need to get a sponsor. She told me what I needed to do. She said, Dennis, you need to get a sponsor that believes this is life or death for him and for you. And who will meet with you regularly and take you through the 12 steps. That's going to be the answer for you. And when I gave her, I tried to hit her with all my problems, all this stuff. You know, newcomers have a lot of stuff going on. She basically told me that the 12 steps would be the answer for all of that stuff. And she asked me another question. I'm not sure still how to answer it to this day, but I did find you guys. She asked me, are they really into the big book down there? And I said, I don't know, but there are these guys, and I think they're trying to recruit me. They call them big book thumpers. They weren't. They just called them that. But she said, Dennis, get a sponsor. So I go home that night, and I'm completely out of my mind, and I call my buddy. I had met him on day two at this men's meeting over on Long Beach Island on Friday nights, and I said, Glenn, who's going to do this? Who can take me through these steps? Who'll be good for me? And he pointed me to a guy who, in a kitchen of a church in Barnegat Light, New Jersey, you know, he was standing there after a meeting, and I was afraid to go up and ask him, like, for a date or something. And I said, Jim, I'm new, and my name is Dennis, and I need a sponsor. Will you sponsor me? And he said, do you want to quit drinking? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you believe you're alcoholic? And I said, well, yeah. And I didn't even know what that meant. I had lived it, but I didn't really understand what was wrong with me. And when I tried to lay all my problems on him, he was like, whoa, I'm not going to be your therapist. I don't know what you should do about your legal problems. Get a lawyer. But I'll take you through the 12 steps, and that will be the answer for you. It was like it was the same stuff that Sheila had told me the day before. And, you know, he immediately started to take me through the steps. And I started to have, like, a little bit of hope, you know. And I told him that I thought, you know, I was so full of self-pity. Like, I just showered and bathed in self-pity every day of my life. And when I got to AA, nothing changed for a little while. Probably for a long while. And I said, Jim, I think I'm too far gone, and I don't think that these steps will work for me. And he said, well, they worked for me. Why don't you believe that I believe? And I said, okay. And he said, do you pray? And I said, And he said, why don't you start praying for the obsession to be removed? Because I had told him I was just out of my mind wanting a drink. And thank God nobody told me, here's $20, go get a drink. Because that was just in my mind. My heart, I didn't want to do it anymore, guys. I couldn't do it anymore. And it started to happen for me. Like, I started to get better, like, very quickly in AA. My friend Glenn, who pointed me to my first sponsor, Jim, he gave me CDs. I'm a CD junkie. I love CDs. I love speakers. I love speaker meetings. And he gave me 55 hours of big book study. And in between meetings, I would sit in front of my speakers at my desk where I used to drink for years and years. And I would just open the book, and I would listen to these speakers, and I would read the book, and I would meet with my sponsor. And, I started to come alive. And what was happening was, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to see what was going on. I was coming to believe that a power could do something for me, like the hopeless guy. And there was evidence of a power in my life very early on in my sobriety. One of the first things that I recall was at about 60 days dry, I woke up and the obsession that I've been talking about for half an hour, it was gone. Like, it wasn't there anymore. And it had chased me around for the better part of 28 years of drinking. And I woke up another day, and it's gone. And now I'm running around the meetings. I'm not sharing at the meetings. I didn't share for like 9 months until I'd been through the steps. I think I was sponsoring someone. Like, I didn't say anything. I was too afraid to, like, know anything. And I was running around before and after the meetings telling everybody, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone. The obsession is gone, you know. And my friend Patrick said, dude, stop talking about it. It's going to come back. Just shut up. And I called Jimmy up, and I said, Jim, I made a decision. And he said, well, what decision did you make? I said, Jim, I made the third step decision. And he said, that's great. You know, I had been working with him like a couple of weeks. He said, that's awesome. We made a date for that week, and we met, and he gave me my four-step instructions. And I'll tell you, I was running around with a lot of new people. And when I went back to them and told them that my sponsor had given me four-step instructions, they told me we were both out of our mind. And I sat down and I wrote that inventory, and when I wrote the fear part, I just sobbed. And I realized that my whole life was just fear. I had just been driven by fear. In fact, when I went through the steps, I was driven by fear. I was driven by fear of the bottle. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I wanted what you guys had so bad. Like, you guys, like, seemed to be, like, happy and doing stuff and smiling, and, you know, you paid attention to me, and You know, people just reached out to me so much. I never felt like I didn't fit in AA. Like, I always came to the meeting and I was like, thank God I found these people. You know, the same people that I said were crazy and was a cult, you know. Like, AA fit me like a glove, and it still does, you know. And I have a little friend, and her name is Madison, and she's one of my best friends in the whole world. She's 9 years old now. When I was when I got sober, she was 4 months old. And maybe I had like 60, 70 days dry, and she and I were in Philadelphia, and she lives right by me. We're in Philadelphia, and we're driving through West Philly going to Chinatown from something, and I don't remember what it was, a kiddies museum or something like that. And I still have my driver's license then. And we're driving, and we're in the city, and she's singing to me. She's singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And I'm bawling in the front seat. I'm just bawling. And then she says, Dennis, I love you as big as the city. And let me tell you, the wheels of the car to the restaurant and then all the way back home across Jersey Lake, like they weren't on the ground, man. And talk about, like, feeling power flow in and having hope. And what was happening, looking back, was I was coming to believe in a power greater than myself. Not only in it, but maybe he could help me. And I mean, it was incredible. It was unbelievable. And I made a host of friends. And I got a home group. And I went to a lot of meetings. And I started, while I had my driver's license, I started to cart guys around. I went to court 6 or 7 times my first 6 months sober. And, you know, every time I went, it got a little bit easier to go. And guys from AA, they wanted to come and sit with me, but I was too proud to watch them, to have them see me go off in handcuffs, because that's what I thought was going to happen. And so I would just have them, like, drop me off or whatever up there, you know? Like, at my this pride, man, it's just a killer. You know, I mean, I finally did lose my license in June, 6 months. I was 6 months sober, and, you know, when I was drinking, even though, like, I was in a deplorable state drinking alone and doing who knows what in my own house by myself, my friends had kind of, like, were disgusted with me and left me alone. And I would drive by the bus stop, and I would think, guys my age were there on bicycles, and I would think, like, look at these losers. These DUI victims. Because I thought I was better, you know. And that following winter, I was at that bus stop with my skateboard under my arm. I was 43 years old, riding a longboard around town. And I fit in on that bus, man. I was no different than anybody. I'm just another person. And thank God I found you guys, man. It's just been unbelievable. And it hasn't all been, you know, it would be nice if I could tell you about, you know, how awesome it's been and how many people I've helped and, you know, God, God, God. But I'll tell you what, man, sometimes being me is a struggle. And sometimes I really have to, like, beg God to walk me through these fears that I have. Like, this fear that, like, I might not be good enough, that I might end up alone again with the bottle. And, you know, last spring I was going through this crazy financial insecurity. The problem was I was making a little money, but I was just blowing it all. And I wasn't paying my bills. And, you know, my I was getting behind again on my mortgage. And, you know, I had a job and I left it for this other job. And then, you know, when I got my first job when I was 14 years old, my folks told me, don't leave a job unless you have another one lined up. Well, I left a job because the guy didn't talk to me nice or some nonsense like that. And I'm just lazy. I probably just wanted the summer off or something. But I went home and I couldn't find work. And I panicked. And I became, like, overcome with fear. And I laid in bed and I watched the fan go around, man. And I couldn't get up. I couldn't move. I was just paralyzed. And I got up, and I found this little job, and I was too prideful to tell anyone what it was. It was working in a sushi restaurant, but I worked in the back, and most of that job was I was going to wash dishes. And I had worked in restaurants all my life. I have a culinary arts degree. And, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody I'm a dishwasher, but, I mean, the money wasn't bad, and it would have bailed me out, you know. See, I thought that getting a job and making money was what was going to bail me out. And I'm washing dishes at that job, and I feel like a piece of crap. And, like, the next day, now my mind's coming from the other side, and it's saying, man, you can do this. You're a sober member of AA, recovered alcoholic. You're washing these dishes for God. You have a new employer, and it's not this guy. You're good. You're fine. And it was actually one time that I came to this meeting. It was a Monday night, and this girl was speaking here, Olivia. And I came up with a couple of my friends, and it was my first day off from this job that I thought had saved me. And I'm driving across New Jersey. I have my driver's license back now. This is just last year. And I get a call, and it's them on the caller ID. And they fired me from the dishwashing job. I couldn't even tell those guys. And those guys were like, call them back. Find out why. Find out why? Are you kidding me? And when I got up here, like, I couldn't even look at people. I was just like, yeah, hey, me, I, you know, whatever. I was dying inside, and I was afraid to tell anybody, you know. And I went home, and I laid back in the bed. You can hold my calls. I laid back in my bed, and now my mind's working on me. And I'm really afraid, because it's saying, you know, Den, you haven't smoked any weed in 3.5 years, and it's not booze, and nobody will know. So, you know, you need a little relief right now, right? You're dying inside. And I'm afraid to tell anybody. I don't want to tell you. I want to tell you how good I'm doing. And, you know, again, my sponsor would tell me, you better just beg God. And that's what I did. And in January, I opened a little painting business, and I'm doing okay. You know, I have work. And I feel good about myself. And I begged God to get me through that. And it was not easy. Thank God I have a lot of friends, man, and a little bit of reliance on this power, and guys to work with. But I was so afraid, and I was so afraid to tell anyone. And what it's like now, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. My grandma, she has always championed me my whole life, and she's 96 years old now, and she and I are like this. She says, Dennis, you're not only my best friend, you're not only my grandson, you're my best friend. She confides in me now about things that she doesn't talk to with her 3 children. Like, they don't have patience for her sometimes, and like, I do. My grandma had patience for me. And before she went to Florida for the winter, she's actually kind of on her way back now. I took her to Jersey City. I saw her a lot over the summer, but I took her to Jersey City, and we were just watching the tugboats, and we're there by the, we walked through the 9/11 memorial, and I said, Grandma, where do you want to go for lunch? And she said, oh, I don't care. And I said, well, of course I'm selfish. And I said, do you want Chinese food or Italian? I wanted Chinese food, so I kind of like baited her a little. She's an Italian lady, and she said, oh, I want Italian food. So we cruised through the tunnel, and we got into the city, and we're going up Spring Street, and we're going across Soho to Little Italy. And Grandma says, we're in New York? She says, Spring Street? I said, yeah, Grandma, we're going to Little Italy for lunch. And she starts to tell me the story about how her parents met on Spring Street, like in the early part of the last century. I mean, my God, don't miss this stuff. It was incredible. Thank God I found you guys. You know, my mom, she never left my side. She never did. Sometimes she tried, but she never really did, you know. And she says it's unbelievable that she can have a conversation with me now and that I don't lash out at her. And I've become like the go-to guy in my family because my family has a lot of problems and a lot of drama. And I've been trying to, like, teach my mom a little bit, you know, about how sick the drama is And how if you keep telling people your drama story, Ma, you're going to suck them into it and you're all going to be sick, you know? And she says, like, she's learning from me. And she loves you guys. Like, she loves AA. And, man, my little friend Madison, she's 9 years old now. And last week we went to the Cape May Zoo and we went to Wildwood. And, man, we're like this. I mean, we're like thick as thieves, me and this kid. And we're like, she's really grown up and we're just like together. We're just at peace. And we never had a discipline problem, Maddie and I, because I just let her do whatever she wants, and then there's no discipline problem. But then I would drop her off home, and she would be like, bat shit crazy, and they would call me and say, what the hell did you do with Madison all day? Like, well, I don't know. I just let her do whatever she wanted. But, man, we go fishing. We go canoeing. We go hiking in the Pine Barrens. She loves to go to restaurants. I mean, man, what a gift it's been, you know. It's been unbelievable. And I have so much to be grateful for. It's been an unbelievable, unbelievable ride for me. And I love doing road trips. I mean, I love to just get in the car and drive. You know, yesterday we took a ride down to this group down in Delaware. And I'm driving with this guy, and he's pretty new. And he's like, what do you just pick a meeting, like, out of the list down in Delaware and you go to it? Well, that would be crazy. No, I just, like, I know people. Like, I was this isolated dude who just sat in his house and drank scotch like it was like honey to me. And now I have all of you guys, you know. And I have a home group, and it's in Barnegat. We meet on Saturday nights. It's a one-hour speaker meeting like this. And it's like the highlight of my week is to go to that group, and we show up early. Like, you guys were here early tonight, a couple guys, and we show up there at 6:30. And I love just watching, like, the vibe. And we make CDs. And I'm, like, the CD guy. And, like, I just love it. And, you know, it's all because two guys dropped what they were doing because they got a phone call from a guy that was dying, and it was me. And they came out, and they got me. And they showed me a life that's just, like the book says, it's indescribably wonderful. And, when I got here, I got a sponsor, and I did what he said. And I was very, very willing, and I like to believe that I still am. I see a lot of guys come, and I see a lot of guys go. And, man, what I see is first they get the job, then they get the car, then they get the girl, then they get the bottle. Anything that distracts me from doing this deal. You know, my sponsor wasn't one of those guys who told me, don't get in a relationship. He just told me, look, this is not a good idea. I don't know, I did anyway, whatever. Yeah, I learned from all my mistakes, you know. But I'm not distracted from my primary purpose here. You know, I'm AA full time. And someone may say, like someone not here, may say, man, all he does is that AA stuff. Well, I love it. And I love you guys. And when people ask me to do something here in AA, like, I really just suit up. And Sarah asked me to wear a jacket and a tie, and I'm a house painter, guys. I walk around like a drop cloth, I look like, you know? And, like, coming here and speaking, like, it didn't really hit me until I got in the bathroom and I started putting these clothes on. I was, like, uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, my God. And then this nervousness came over me, and I realized all the coffee I drank. And but, my God, there's nothing to be scared about. There's nothing bad in AA, you know. You guys are just, wherever I go, like, I feel like I'm with my people. When I, 2 weeks ago, we went on this Garden State Young People's camping trip, and it was up in Sussex County, New Jersey, by the Delaware Water Gap. And when I left you guys, it was like 200 of us. On the ride home, I was having just this weird feeling, like just this like separation anxiety. And like I can't say that I ever feel like I need to go to a meeting, but I just needed to be like around you guys. And then when I walked into a meeting, I just felt like, oh, here they are. Same people, just different faces, you know, same stuff. Sick people, well people, nice people, shitty people, yeah, just everybody. Like I fit in AA, you know, and I never fit in anywhere else in my life, you know. So if you're new, man, just like find somebody, and there's plenty of people out there that'll help you wherever you are. And you know what used to happen to me when I first started to get into the big book? I would go to a lot of meetings, and it's no secret that some of the meetings in AA, they could be crazy. But I got sober there, so I'm not like downing any of that. But I would go to these meetings, and one guy would raise his hand and share. And I would be like, my God, that's one of those big book people. And then I would go up to him or her, and I wouldn't know what to say, but I would just be like, me too. I'm right in my fourth step. My sponsor's into the book, and they would be like, dude, just do whatever he says. And then they would tell me where their home group was, and I would go and take a road trip there, you know, and it's been incredible. You know, they gave me my driver's license back after 2 years. And I got around great in AA for 2 years. I took the bus, and I made do. And I don't think I was a burden on anyone. I always coughed up some gas money. You know, if you're new and you wonder why the guys don't want to come back and pick you up, maybe you should kick in some gas money. That's a good idea, you know. It was a good idea for me, you know. Sounds self-seeking, it is, but you got to do what you got to do. And, you know, my family life has gotten a lot better. And I've made a lot of amends in my family. I made amends to my Aunt Lynn, who I had just ripped our relationship apart. And then for a year sober, I continued to do the same things and exhibit the same behavior. And I harmed her again. And I got a text from her tonight. We're meeting for Mother's Day on Sunday. Do you want to come up, you know? And I was the guy that they avoided. And I said, yeah, I do. I want to be there. You know, grandma's going to be there. What a gift to have your grandma, 96 years old, you know, and be sober and be an example of this thing, you know. I have a brother that he may or may not be one of us. I mean, I guess that's for him to. But, man, I think he's missing something, man. He's missing all this. You know, what I like to say to new people is, just come on. Like, come with us. Like, don't miss this. You don't have to stay in that world. It's just one step. Just come with us, you know. Get in the car. Take a road trip with us. Get a sponsor. Read the book. Like, when I picked up the big book, I got one at my first meeting. It blew me away. Nobody had to read it to me. I understood I understood the whole thing. It spoke directly, maybe not the recovery part, but it spoke directly to me. Like, I finally understood, like, what in the world is wrong with me? My favorite word in the book is baffled. My God, I was baffled. And so was my whole family. They would, every time I would do well, a little bit well, they'd be like, oh boy, here he goes. He's got the girl and she's so nice. And then it would just all fall apart and they'd be like, oh no. And anyway, that's about all I got for tonight. I really, I appreciate you guys being here. And I love seeing you guys. And I love hanging with you guys. I love being with you guys. I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all I have. Thank you.